It's Tuesday. Welcome to the show. I'm Elizabeth Barrett, and I'm so glad you're here today. We're actually going to take a little field trip backstage to Live Oak Music Festival for a couple of conversations with singer-songwriters for my annual trek for Backstage Banter. And this week, I have two California-born singer-songwriters that I got a chance to speak with. Very different musicians, very different stories, both a lot of fun. Sam Chase of The Sam Chase and The Untraditional, and I didn't have a conversation scheduled. Usually I have to pre-request the interviews, but for whatever reason, we didn't have one. And I went backstage to meet another artist that I was supposed to have an interview with, and I hadn't met them before. So I wandered up to this group of people sitting together and asked this man who turned out to be Sam Chase if he was someone else. And he looked at me and said, "No, but why didn't you want to talk to me?" And I said, "I would love to talk to you. I didn't know you were available." And he said, "I'm available right now." I said, "Let's go." And it turned out to be one of the most fun conversations of the weekend. Sam is born, raised, and still lives in San Francisco. He fell in love with the three-chord magic of punk rock growing up and then found his own sound with the punk rock blended with some rock and roll and folk music and this really distinct sound backed by a really eclectic band. And he's a lot of fun. And then my first conversation was another California-born singer-songwriter, Emily Nenny, who ended up in Nashville and found her voice and her sound by spending time in the honky-tonks and bars around Nashville and just really resonated with the raw, heartfelt, hard-knock life of country music. She's someone who has put her heart, her hurts, her pain into her music, and most recently in her new album, Move and Shoes, exploring how people treat each other in general and reflecting on her own desire to leave a positive mark on the world through her songs and her shows. So I'm Elizabeth Barrett, and you can find me after the show by sending me an email to elizabeth@thereluctanttherapist.com. You can listen to previous shows at kcbx.org. You can send me a note through Facebook and Instagram. And if you enjoy a podcast, then you can find us as a podcast through Apple Podcasts, NPR Podcasts, Spotify, wherever it is you find your shows. Just look up A Conversation with a Reluctant Therapist, hit subscribe, and we love it if you leave a review so other people can find us as well. You're listening to Central Coast Public Radio, KCBX, and here's Emily Nenny and Living in Shame. I'm curious about how someone decides, "Oh, I'm a singer." Mm-hmm. You know, were you little and it just came out? How did you discover that you had this talent and decide to kind of throw yourself into it?
I always loved to sing. I grew up in a very just music obsessed family. Maybe obsessed is not the right word, but just my father worked in radio from the 70s until last year.
Wait, on a local Bay Area station?
He actually started in New York. He's a New Yorker.
Okay.
And then they moved to California in 85, mm-hmm. and he worked at KOME when I was little in San Jose when we lived there.
Okay, that was our high school station.
Really? Mm-hmm. Yeah, I mean, I still wear the merch. Love KOME. And then when we moved to the Bay, it was Live 105.
Yep.
So he and my mother, who's also just a passionate music listener, they brought us up on all kinds of music. And I was just always singing along. My oldest sister studied opera in college.
Oh, wow.
So she has so much power and knowledge. And then I was just kind of writing my feelings out, really. And
just like journaling, my
yes,
diary.
Yeah, and like singing behind closed doors.
Of course.
No true aspiration to become a performer or singer. just because of my confidence levels and fear.
How old were you, though, when you started writing music and singing to yourself?
Probably 16. That's when I mean, writing probably earlier, but I didn't get a guitar and learn how to even play basic chords until I was 16. And that was really special. When I got my first guitar, I cried. It was like the most special.
Were you surprised? Was it a surprise gift?
I was so surprised, yes. It was a $100 Sigma Martin, and it was just the most special. And it came with a little certificate that had, like, here, you're going to go to your first guitar lesson today.
Oh, I love that.
This sweet, sweet man named Jack Eskridge. I'll never forget him. Great mustache. Great toupee.
Perfect look.
Yes, yes.
Perfect. Mm-hmm. What was the first song you learned?
I think we were strumming probably the Eagles, Take It Easy.
Okay.
You know, it's three
Not
chords.
Not Smoke on the Water.
No.
That's our my generation.
We didn't get yeah.
That was my first, Smoke on the Water. And nice. Then House of the Rising Sun.
Oh, very good.
Which is incredibly inappropriate because I think I was about 11.
Yeah. Yeah. Maybe not the, for that age, but
exactly. And so did you immediately with the guitar start getting the confidence? Like, who was the first person that got to hear you not behind closed doors?
I think I performed with some friends singing harmony and strumming guitar. We sang for like a high school performance. We did like one song together. I think it was like Bring It On Home to Me or something.
Okay.
And then the first time I played solo was in a room of like 8 people. It was for a senior project. I just did a whole semester researching at different songwriters, and it was, you know, nothing like very intensive, but record little covers on my garage band and on my mom's computer, her work computer, and then write about these different songwriters and performers. And I wrote one song and I performed it in front of a group of 7 or 8 people, and it was very scary, but they were very supportive.
Now, was this in high school or college?
This was senior year of high school.
Oh, wow.
And yeah.
I don't know many high schools that do a senior project, so that's...
Yeah, it was my English class the second semester. It was called a WISE project. I don't remember what it stood for. That was a long time ago.
Mm-hmm.
But my English teacher just allowed us to pick a subject we wanted to explore for a semester.
What a great idea.
Yeah, it was really special. He was great. He was also my freshman year English teacher, Mr. Poling.
Thank you, Mr. Poling. Man.
Yes. Lovely guy. Steven, I believe his first name was. Yeah. Nice guy.
And so once this, because I'm looking for that nugget of, when did the sassy come out? When did you find your voice and like, oh no, I'm not shy anymore about what I have to say.
You know, it was probably my early 20s.
Okay.
after a relationship in which I was not treated well and was still being hard on myself and probably blaming myself for things, and then later realizing like, hey, actually that wasn't me, that was somebody who probably needed to work on themselves. And he definitely did. But
did we write a song about him?
Oh, I've written, he's on every record. Cause you know, that was 10-12 years ago, but 12 years ago. Yeah. But still certain things that come up, you know, emotionally, and you go, that's from you still, you know,
but then you get to turn it into something that gives you joy.
Yes.
That's a great revenge.
Yes, it absolutely is. And yeah, to sing and, even if it's, you know, faking strength now and again, it is, it's good to sing about those things and remind yourself like, hey, you are still someone, you're still strong. You didn't deserve to be treated that way. Yeah.
So do you think it was music that helped you feel empowered, you know, to use your voice, or did something else, did you go to college after high school?
I briefly went to college, in Chicago, Columbia College in Chicago, to study audio engineering. I had had a reconstructive back surgery when I was 17. So
my
last week of junior year of high school. And then you know, was in bed pretty much for that summer, went into senior year of high school. My body was still recovering. I was recovering mentally from it. It was very intense.
That's months.
Yes.
That you're out of your life as a teenager. Yeah. That's huge.
Yes. Yeah. Very removed from that, you know, teenage experience.
Right. Because it's very much formative, right? Yes. You're making those lifetime relationships. Mm-hmm. Everyone's doing things and you're missing it. I would imagine the FOMO.
Yeah, the FOMO. Must
have been horrible.
And you know, that probably, because I also, you know, my parents are here today. I'm so lucky to have the relationship I have with them, and they've always been so supportive and encouraging. And I know you don't get that every day with any career.
No, absolutely. Because parents usually have an idea of which career they want you to choose.
Yes, yes. And you know, when I started out, at Columbia College, and then a year and a half in, it wasn't for me. I think I was also just not ready to be, I was still recovering from my back stuff and figuring things out. I still had a lot of maturing to do because I kind of like was preoccupied with my health for a while.
Mm-hmm.
Anyway.
And I would wonder too, that was a big move to go to Chicago.
It was. I had never been away from home for that long, that far, and it was good, you know. I just think I wasn't there yet. And then moving to Nashville, I think once I got up on stage and was encouraged by certain people, like my buddies, Santa's at Santa's Pub in Nashville. It's just a double wide trailer that's very
special.
Is
it really?
Yeah. And Sunday nights are it's a live honky tonk band from 7 to 9, and the night I met them, they invited me up to play, and I wasn't like, I didn't play guitar because I said, I can't do that yet, play guitar and sing with a band. And the next week they're like, try it. And I just felt so supported and encouraged, and they just, that community, that group really helped my confidence.
Yeah. How did you get from Chicago to Nashville though? Did you go back home for a certain period of time?
I went back home for a year, lived with my parents and worked at this luxury gym at the front desk. My shift started at 4:30 in the morning. The gym opened at 5. Worked from like 4:30 to 2 p.m. and then go home, take care of the dog, make my parents dinner, and then I would write in the afternoons too, and just work on that until I moved to Nashville. Yeah, saved money up and moved to Nashville to go to college. And then
that's what I was gonna ask.
That wasn't really it either. I think that just wasn't my path. No. And I didn't think that was allowed for a while.
But I think that's very common, don't you?
Absolutely.
Because your parents invest, again, the parental dream of where we think our kids are gonna end up.
Yeah.
And that's a big, and so it becomes part of your narrative, even if your parents were like, no, you're fine, but you've heard it so long that you're like, wait, I'm breaking a rule.
Yes. Breaking a rule. And also when something is such a privilege, many people who don't get to get an education can't afford it. You feel guilty not taking that experience, you know, but it's not, it's just not for everybody.
You've had a different college, I would imagine.
Mm-hmm. Yes.
If you're just tuning in, this is a conversation with a reluctant therapist. I'm Elizabeth Barrett. And my guest backstage at Live Oak right now is Emily Nenny. Yes. Who joins us on Friday, first day out, one of the first people up on main stage. So I appreciate you taking the time to sit and chat with me for a little bit. I'm curious about you talked about, I don't know how much you want to go into it, about your medical history with your back. Mm-hmm. And that's a giant crisis for a young person or any person to go through. Mads, how much do you think that impacted your choice of careers or what to do with your life? Ooh. Having lived through that?
That definitely gave me, years later, after looking back on it, because at the time I wasn't thinking, man, this is really hard and you're navigating something very challenging at a young age. And if you can do that, you can do anything. Now I look back and I go, okay, I handled that. This might be hard, but you can do this. But yeah, at the time, that's certainly not where I was at.
And I would imagine it would take like your whole sense of trusting your body again and feeling like you're whole. And when you're 16 and an adolescent, all of that's already jumbled.
Yes. Yeah. And I wore a back brace in middle school, 7th and 8th grade. So that was a time when I was already insecure about my body. And then that took I still write about, like I have a song on my latest record called Living in Shame, and it is largely about, you know, how I'm feeling in my body and why am I being hard on myself and my body when I genuinely, everybody I see is beautiful, and all these conversations I have with my sisters or my mm-hmm. friends. And yeah, it really, it is so hard to hear the people that you love, you know, talk poorly about themselves. But
how? What do you think are the biggest challenges for young women in their 30s, your cohort? What are you grappling with as a generation?
I think we are, a lot of women I am realizing are hopefully feeling more at home in their bodies. Mm-hmm. But I think as your hormones are fluctuating, like that is, I was just diagnosed with endometriosis and PCOS like last year.
Yeah, those, one of those is a huge diagnosis. Huge. To have both?
Yeah. Yeah. So navigating that, I haven't shared this publicly, mm-hmm. but had a laparoscopic procedure to have a answer to why my body was feeling so terrible. Mm-hmm. Had endometriosis removed and then recovered for a few weeks and then hit the road, went on tour, which maybe wasn't the best idea, but I still had a great time on tour. But talking to women, yeah, a lot of it is, you know, our hormones, and as our hormones are changing as they do throughout our lives, how that's affecting our mind and our body. So I think a lot of it is the mental and the physical for women at any age.
How about the piece of that, some timeline that women feel like that they're on more so than men do?
Yes.
As far as checking things, getting mm-hmm. married, having a family, like how is that sitting with you? Because you're in the middle of this burst of your career.
Mm-hmm. You know, I guess my one of my sisters has two beautiful kids, and I think just looking at her and her lovely husband and her beautiful kids, I adore them. I am very happy to be an auntie though.
Okay.
You know, I think I'm, this is very cliche, but like my art is, you know, my baby.
Yeah. And I don't know if that's cliche. I think it's the truth. Yeah.
Yeah. That might change. Mm-hmm. And I might just find that out not too late, but like pretty late in the game, I might find that out. But,
because there is a timeline, you know, totally. As much as we don't want to mm-hmm. have that, but again, men don't have this same kind of crunch
yeah.
of your 30s mm-hmm. of how do I make these choices? Yeah. And I don't want to get to 45 and think I made the wrong one. Yeah. But at the same time, do you table your work? I think that'd be really, really hard.
Well, not just on, you know, your decision with your time, but the people that you work with. My friend Michaela Ann, she's a very gifted songwriter and musician. She has two kids and has been very open about her journey as a mother and a musician and working with booking agents and people who maybe were dismissive or were mm-hmm. not looking to work with her as much because she was pregnant or because right. she had
she
children.
Seemed limited in yes. her availability or
yeah mm-hmm. but she's so inspiring. She's making it so I'm just able to see what she's doing, and she's in grad school. She has a podcast with her husband. She's recording. She's like doing all these magnificent things, and she's sharing so much. But seeing someone like that, I'm like, and she just hit 40, and she has like two lovely kids and is also achieving so much. Mm. I think, you know, everybody, women are so, so capable of doing it all.
Oh, yes.
But also taking care of yourself and like, gosh, it's hard.
You don't have to have completed it all mm-hmm. by 35 or even 40.
So
or,
true.
There is this like intense sense that if you don't have it all done, that you can never come back.
Yeah. Yeah.
That's a lot to put on people. Because again, I don't think men have the same pressure because generally they have a partner at home.
Right.
To cover
right.
it.
Completely. Yeah. Completely. And I mean, think of even where you want to be, milestones in a music career, for yes. instance, that looks very different, woman versus a man or whomever. It's there are, it seems to me, unless mm-hmm. you are, you know, Emmylou Harris, who, of course, she's still...
Interesting, that's yeah. who the first person you told.
I love her. But, you know, you see these old rock and rollers on stage, these men who are still doing it and have, no matter what they're looking like, but, you know, a woman, she's showing her age.
Do you worry about that in music?
You know, I don't want to, so I am hoping that I am, as I progress in my career, I'm hoping that I am making it clear that it's the music that matters. I want to wear a fun top, of course, but I think it should be about the music and the connection with your listeners and the subject matter that you're talking about. Like I want to be able to sing these songs 30, 40 years from now. Mm-hmm. I think that's what's mattering to me. And yeah.
What are you writing right now? What's your next, if people want to jump on the Emily Nenny train, what should they be listening to and what's coming up?
Ooh, I released my record called Move and Shoes May 1st of this year. And I'm just starting to write with my friend Misa Arriaga in Nashville. We've been talking about writing together for 10 years. I normally write by myself, but we're going to write together and record. And yeah, I just put out my last record on the New West Records label, and I am not sure what's next. So that's kind of something I'm, you know, tapping into, the uncertainty, but also the excitement in that, and which we are all going to hit at multiple points in our lives, the uncertainty, and which is freeing, but also very scary.
Terrifying.
Yeah.
But it is when all the growth happens.
Absolutely.
All the growth happens in the unknown.
Yeah.
I'm always curious, like, how do your songs come to you? Are you a journaler? Do you wake up from a dream and it's there? Like, where does your inspiration come for your music?
It mainly comes from me fixating on something that has happened.
Okay.
And needing to figure out why it's bothering me
mm-hmm.
and how I feel about it and what I would... I can't respond to things immediately. I really need to think it through, because if I'm responding immediately, I'm an emotional person.
Okay.
I will admit it. And there's beauty, and that can be tough. There's beauty in that. And I can, that sometimes doesn't go great, but yeah, I just, something that just is bothering. If someone is not, wanting to communicate about something and I'm just, it's sitting in my head, that is how I work through it. Or that's how I work through it, and then I'm able to talk to somebody.
What's a song you've written just pure reactive and didn't take the time to process it through?
Ooh, oh, that's a great question. Well, it was with an ex of mine. It's called Baby Found the Bottle, and it was about him drinking heavily, and in hindsight I feel like that was a very sensitive time and a sensitive subject, and I don't think that was the kindest thing I could have written, so I do regret that. But also it was pretty catchy. We just don't play it live anymore.
On purpose? As yes. a gift to that person? Or
Yes. And his family. I thought that was probably, yeah. In hindsight, I look back and I go, okay.
Cathartic, right. Though.
Yes. Yeah, well, absolutely.
And also, how many years have people been trying to figure out your So Vain's character,
right?
Like,
right.
Couldn't this be your So Vain?
Yeah, certainly could be.
You might
absolutely.
Need to bring it back.
Yeah.
Emily, thank you for giving me some of your time here backstage
at
Live
Oak.
Thank you
so much. So good to talk to you.
Yeah, I appreciate you. And I look forward to sharing your music with other people, because I will have it in the show.
Thank you so much.
We'll be playing some tunes. You've been listening to Emily Nenny. This is a conversation with a reluctant therapist. I'm Elizabeth Barrett. And we're backstage at Live Oak Music Fest 2026. More to come right here on Central Coast Public Radio, KCBS.
My baby found the bottle, and my baby lost his mind.
You've been listening to my conversation with singer-songwriter Emily Nenni backstage at Live Oak Music Festival. I'm Elizabeth Barrett, and this is a conversation with a reluctant therapist right here on Central Coast Public Radio, KCBX. And next up is my conversation with Sam Chase of The Sam Chase and The Untraditional. We had so much to cover, I don't want to waste any time. So let's jump right in, get introduced to their sound with their latest ode to San Francisco. This will be Condos You Can't Afford. From The Sam Chase and The Untraditional, this is Central Coast Public Radio, KCBX.
Living in the city is hard enough. All we ask is for a place where we can live it up. But the wrecking ball is coming knocking on the door. This will be condos you can't afford. This will be condos that you can't afford. Tearing down the walls of a hallowed hall where we honor all the gods of rock and roll. Dancing on the grave where our sweat was poured. This'll be condos that you can't afford. This'll be condos that you can't afford. I believe there'll be a place to lay my head after the work is done, waiting for me in the end.
And we're back.
Yes, we are. We're actually backstage at Live Oak Music Festival with the incomparable Sam Chase. So this was my first time getting to see you on stage.
And I'm incomparable?
And incomparable because...
From the first time? That's amazing.
I'm going to tell you why. Because I was back here doing interviews and the audience was reacting like there was a magician on stage. You know, where there's a lot of, ooh, oh. And I was like, what is this guy doing? Is he pulling things out of his hat? And I came around a corner, but you were just playing music, but the audience was on fire.
It's musical sleight of hand.
Yeah.
It's all like, smoke and mirrors musically.
But does that always happen where it's the ooh and ah effect? Like you've done something, ripped off a shirt or cut someone in half?
I've never had the wherewithal to take off my shirt. Okay. However, I mean, people always say, you know, I'm going to see a show. They don't go, right. I'm going to hear a show. So What we do is we give them a show to see. And that may mean a lot of audience participation, a lot of, you know, silly dance moves, trying to get the audience to play along, creating a reciprocal relationship with the audience, gaining their trust,
yeah,
fulfilling our contractual obligation to the people that hired us to entertain.
This is deep.
Yeah, well, I could go on.
Please do.
No, for us, it's a release. Mm-hmm. And for the audience, because I've been in the audience before, if you can give them that release as well, then it just creates this reciprocal release, this constant relationship release where they're giving it back to us and then we're giving it back to them. And it builds and builds and builds to the point, yeah, where you might see some oohs and ahs.
Yeah.
And who knows, maybe tonight I'll rip my shirt off.
I know that you did double barrel and you said this was the quiet set this afternoon compared to tonight.
Yeah, and I was sweating hard during that soft set.
It's come to the big one. I was thinking too that reciprocal experience with the audience, do you feel more energized when you come off the stage rather than that feeling I've just spent myself, you know, when you're getting that feedback?
I mean, a little bit of both because, you know, you still have the adrenaline that's like pumping through your system. So you're still really excited. But at the same time too, like you've kind of shut off the Sam Chase character and turned back on the Sam Chase person.
Okay.
You know, so it's like, you know, so it's one dimmer switch and having another one come back on. And, you know, The Sam Chase, the person, you know, is no slouch, but definitely not the showman that The Sam Chase is.
And again, the title of your band is The Sam Chase and The
Untraditional.
Untraditional.
Yeah.
So is this speaking in third person, Sam Chase, or do you go by The Sam Chase when you're not on stage?
I mean, do you want the true story?
No, I do want the true story. Okay, so I am a therapist.
Okay. Well, then here's the truth. I was at home a long time ago before I even started this band, and I had roommates, and I was in my bedroom, doors closed, and my roommate came banging on the door, and I opened the door and he was like, I'm a famous race car driver. And he said, and I said, no, you're not. You're a video game tester. And I've seen you drive and I'll never get in a car with you. You are not a race car driver. And he said, no, my name is like, I have the same name. And he's got this weird name, but I have the same name of a famous race car driver. And I was like, oh, that's kind of cool. And he was like, you should Google yourself. And I was like, I should Google myself. So I Googled myself, and it turns out that I am a folk singer from Boston, Massachusetts, who is about 5'8", slightly swarthy complexion, and sings songs about, you know, emotional heartbreak and drinking too much. And I was like, oh, man, because that wasn't me.
Oh, it wasn't?
No, that was somebody else.
Oh,
so
actually someone else was already living your life?
Named Sam Chase from Boston. I'm from San Francisco.
Oh, well, there you go. Those are two different, you know, worlds.
Two different universes. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. And so I was like, well, that really sucks, because that's kind of in the direction that I'm going at this time. So, you know, how am I going to beat this guy to the punch and also not get sued for copyright stuff?
Exactly.
And I was like, well, best way to beat him to the punch is to put something in front of Sam Chase. And that's the Sam Chase. And so I am the Sam Chase. And I thought that that was funny, because I didn't think that this project was going to go anywhere. At the time, I was playing in punk bands all over, and we were doing moderately well. And, you know, I liked these softer songs, these acoustic songs, to kind of expose my soft white underbelly to the masses. But I didn't think it was going to go anywhere. So I thought it was kind of a joke.
Right.
And so I put these songs out as the Sam Chase. And then the punk stuff didn't work out. And then this stuff started to take off. And I was like, oh, well.
I am the Sam Chase.
And now that's me. And, you know, people always ask me, like, you know, why?
Yeah.
Why thee? And
yeah.
I'm like, because I'm an egomaniac. What do you think?
I always think I thought it was like the, is it Instagram or the Twitter thing where you have to have the,
I thought that I started that.
You must have, because how long have you been the Sam Chase?
I can only imagine since Instagram started, whatever year that was.
Before that, that's exciting.
Yeah, I mean, my email was thesamchase@gmail.com since
if
Gmail
you had said Hotmail,
thing.
I would have been more impressed.
No, it was Nirvana60 at Hotmail.
There you go.
Yeah.
We all had to start with the embarrassing Hotmail.
Yeah,
that's
yeah.
So funny.
Yeah, there were 59 other Nirvanas at Hotmail.
All right, so Sam Chase. Can I call you just Sam Chase?
Yes.
Or do
you can call me
you
Sam. You can call me
okay.
Sam
Mr. Chase.
You can call me Mr. Chase.
How did we get to being on stage and getting to see you today? You grew up in the Bay Area. I'm a Bay Area kid. That's
You're from true. The Bay.
I am from the Bay. Mm-hmm. But were you a musical family kid? Were you a dark, angsty teen? Like, where did the music thing happen for you?
Well, when I was growing up, my dad played acoustic guitar and sang. And
just at the house or out in the world?
Just at the house.
Okay.
Because he had two kids. And every night he had a packed house in our bedroom.
It held audience.
Yeah. The sellout was two. And it was tiered. It was a bunk bed. So, you know, I was up in the balcony. And he'd pull out his guitar every single night and sing us to bed. And he'd sing us Tennessee Stud. And he'd sing, you know, Johnny Cash. And he'd sing us, you know, a bunch of other of those types of songs, Bob Dylan and stuff. And he always also would sing Angel from Montgomery by John Prine.
It's my favorite to sing.
It's a lot of people's favorites to sing. And my dad,
I hate to be boring.
Oh, no. And neither was my dad. I mean, you probably have your own very particular rendition of it, too.
Mine's Bonnie Raitt rendition, so.
My dad's was very much his.
Mm.
Because he kind of sings like you'd expect after hearing me. The apple doesn't fall far from the tree. And he sings it so much differently. I think he was a big John Prine fan, but he kind of had kind of a Bonnie Raitt kind of twang to it, but it was loud.
Mm-hmm.
And I thought that my dad wrote that song.
Oh, you did?
Until I was way too old. Like I was in college.
You must have thought he was the king.
I thought, yeah. I mean, he was my first concert, you know?
Yeah.
And then I was in college and my buddy picked up the guitar in my dorm and he started strumming it. And he was like, I am an old woman. Named after my mother. And I was like, how the hell do you know that song? And he was like, it's John Prine. And I was like, of course it is.
Wait, you didn't believe him at first?
I mean, I realized that my life was a lie in that moment. And I was like, yes, of course, it's John Prine. I need to call my dad real quick. You know, so like that was kind of my musical upbringing was you know, my dad playing guitar, but I had no interest in following in those footsteps at that time. It wasn't until I found punk rock music. And then you know, coming from a somewhat musical family in that regard, I was able to step into the world of punk rock music on guitar, playing loud, angsty guitar.
But I really need to know, why punk rock music? Why did that speak to you?
Punk rock music is the folk music of my generation and my part of the world.
Okay.
You know, I never was a big Grateful Dead fan, to be honest. And, you know, to each their own. I realize I'm on the wrong side of history, you know. However,
because you were Nirvana 60, and that's not punk.
Well, my intro into loud music was probably Nirvana.
Okay.
You know, and so then that was heavy and loud and angsty. And from there, I was, you know, I learned every Nirvana song you can learn. And then from there, it went into thrash metal and stuff like that. And then punk rock music. And punk rock music for me, and that, getting to your question that you asked, is the three chords and the truce of my generation in that part of the world at that time. That was my Woody Guthrie, the political punk that was singing the songs about the things that mattered, especially for kids on the streets in the cities. Like, that was the stuff that mattered to me. This Land Is Your Land didn't really speak to me as much, you know. The Grateful Dead stuff.
Yeah, and I get
you know, it just wasn't for me. I mean, you know, Phil Lesh, when I was busking one time, put a $5 bill in my guitar case and then walked away, and I called him a cheap. I've got a lot of...
Did he come back and slug you?
No, no. He gave me another five. No, I'm just kidding. He kept walking. I said it really under my breath. and I mean, I've got so much Grateful Dead street cred. Like, I've like hung out with Wavy Gravy, played him a song, and he was like, wow, that's amazing. You know, it's like he sat on the side of the stage while we're playing music.
That's so wild a reference to, because one of the first shows I ever went to with my husband, we were dating 46 years ago, was a Seva concert that Wavy Gravy was.
Oh, really? I played one of the Seva concerts.
Did you?
Too. Yeah. That was, he was sitting side stage and we played our opening song and I heard Wavy Gravy go, wow, man. And I was like, that's the best response we've ever had to the first song of a show we've ever played.
That's fabulous.
Yeah. It's pretty cool.
Does the Clash count into this?
Sure.
Yeah. Radicalization of your musical journey?
The Clash,
or were they too mainstream?
Well, I wouldn't say that the Clash is necessarily too mainstream. It's what they were talking about that's important. You know, there's so many bands that became very popular, and I don't like the term sellout if it means that they're famous. Sellout just means that you went corporate and that you stopped singing about the things that were important. And I don't think Joe Strummer ever did that. You know, Joe Strummer... You know, and he aged appropriately, but he never lost that fire. So he never sold out. I don't think the Clash ever sold out. You know, but there's plenty of other bands that, you know, went corporate and just kind of stopped singing about things that were important and started singing about things that were a little bit more, you know, too many love songs or whatever, just basic stuff that could get on the radio and keep building their hit.
So what happened with the punk journey then? Because you said it didn't work out. What does that mean to you, didn't work out?
Well, I wouldn't say that I'm a failed punk rocker.
Okay.
I'm an evolved punk rocker.
Okay.
And because the songs that we play up on stage, I wouldn't say are that far away from my beginnings.
Okay.
But the punk rock stuff, a lot of my friends weren't necessarily super into. They were of kind of like more Grateful Dead kind of types, or more jam bandy types, or more, you know, softer acoustic kind of stuff. And, you know, they weren't coming to the shows because it was a little bit too loud and in your face for that kind of stuff. And it wasn't until I stripped down to an acoustic guitar and was playing almost basically the same songs that they were like, oh, well, I like this. And I'm like,
you just heard that.
This song's on our last album. You know, and they were like, we should stick with this. And I was like, well, maybe you got a point. And it turned out that they were right. And it kind of, I could take that punk ethos, the stuff I was singing about, and if I stripped it down to a style of music or like an instrument that more people could connect with, I think, you know, I haven't lost that edge, much like Joe Strummer. You know, the Clash wasn't the most punk rock band around by in terms of their tone and how loud they were, but it was what they were singing about. And so I don't think I've lost that edge necessarily. I think I've just evolved in a way that allowed our songs to be able to get in front of more people and bring more people into the world of punk rock.
I like that.
Yeah.
So what is it that you care about that you want to sing about?
Well, I don't sing many love songs.
Okay, don't like love.
I love love.
You have a ring on.
I love love.
Okay.
Love is great.
Okay.
Here's my thing about love songs.
Oh, please, enlighten me.
And then I'll get to your question. Love songs, I think, are cheap. I think they're easy.
Okay.
I think they're an easy way into the heartstrings, you know, because everybody, you know, either wants love or knows love, has experienced mm-hmm. love, has lost love, is hoping
for
more love.
That's why we're on the planet.
Yeah, just more love, right? Mm-hmm. However, they're singing about a very particular type of love most of the time.
Okay.
And that's brand new love. Like, I just met you. I want to stare into your eyes forever. And then, you know, and it's just like, you're the most beautiful thing. I can't believe I saw you from across the room kind of thing. And then they rhyme love with above and they call it a day. And it's a one in a million. Like, every love song is basically the same. You know, I'm like, I've heard it before. I don't need to hear it anymore. But the love songs that I like to write are about mm-hmm. old love.
Okay. How old?
Love, 46 years.
That's me.
Yeah.
Okay. Thanks for pulling that back around.
That's why I write the love songs.
I felt that.
No, it's for, you know, it's for people that like have gone through that honeymoon period and have come out on the other side and are like, I still really like you. Mm. I like hanging out with you. I like the smell of your farts, you know. I like you when you're at your worst, mm-hmm. and I'm overjoyed when you're at your best. But you know, the full, well-rounded person that I've gotten to know is way better than that seeing you from across a room moment. Those are good love songs.
Yeah, it is.
And there aren't enough of them. And so those are the love songs that I like to write.
If someone were just finding the Sam Chase, what would be one of the love songs you would want them to start out with?
Of ours?
Mm-hmm. Unless you'd like to rep somebody else.
Yeah. Elton John's Your Song is pretty good.
Well, I think maybe I'm amazed, but...
Yeah. That is a good one.
Mm-hmm. But the Sam Chase...
I'd say There For Me is a really good song, okay. because that is kind of about when I'm at my worst. Mm. And through all of it, you're still there for me. It doesn't paint a very good picture of myself, but it paints a really good picture of the relationship that, you know, and you know, there's always got to be a twist.
Okay.
You know, there's always got to be like, you know, I come off as not a particularly good partner in the beginning, but by the end, it, you know, the love that I'm giving, even though I can't necessarily be there all the time because I'm on the road and stuff like that, I'm always there, even if I'm not physically there.
Is it like a redemption song?
Yeah, a little bit. I mean, it's more kind of a journey of just like, it starts, you have an idea of who I am. And then once it gets to the end, you realize that it's like, not only am I singing that you are there for me, it's her singing that back to me, that I'm there for her.
So who's the person that you're singing these old love songs to?
My wife. I mean, I wrote it for her. She's a musician too. And so she understands the long nights on the road and stuff and, you know, not being fully present all of the time. Mm-hmm. Coming back from the road and just wanting to like bury my head in a pillow for a couple of days and stuff like that.
Are you still in San Francisco?
I am, yeah. Hanging on for dear life.
Yeah, it probably feels like that.
Yeah.
And so when you're... I don't know how old you are. I don't know if you feel like you can tell me, or you're trying to stay cool and young.
No, I am cool and young. I'm 43.
Oh, you are young. But I guess I'm curious, at 43, are you still as energized about this as you were when you were writing punk songs? Is it more a job now? Like, where are you in your journey of music? Are you still trying to get someplace?
I've kind of not given up on the dream of like playing stadiums and stuff. Mm-hmm. I've kind of just like come to the realization that the avenue that I want is more of an achievable goal. And that is to just keep going and to keep progressing. It's not some far off goal. It's just, if things keep going at a slight uptick, you know, if we just keep progressing more and more, that's exactly what I want.
Is that in terms of the music that you're writing or the gigs that you're getting?
Both. Okay. You know, the music that I'm writing, the gigs that I'm getting, the response that we're getting, you know, the fan base that is building. I do it for myself first. Mm-hmm. The fact that I wrote these songs first and foremost for myself.
Why?
Because I want it. Because I didn't journal.
Okay.
I didn't have a diary. And so... most of the songs that were on the acoustic guitar, I didn't show to anybody. It was the punk songs that I showed to people. Those are the ones that I really cared about. And, you know, while the soft underbelly songs kind of met up with the punk songs at mm-hmm. a certain point, there definitely is a lot more expression from those things that were written just for myself than there are the things that were, you know, in the punk rock realm. And so, you know, I've kind of brought a version of myself that I can show to people in order to create connection. Like for me, it's all about, you know, connecting with other people. I like to be around people, but I find oftentimes that, like, if I'm at a party, I'm hanging around the food table, just stuffing chips into my mouth and not talking to anybody. And I always feel kind of awkward in those situations. So if there's ever any reason to be able to sit and talk with somebody, mm-hmm. like say if they have a podcast or a radio show,
there we go.
Or if
I don't really have one, by the way, this is how I break that awkward.
Oh, is this not a microphone? Is it just a crystal?
I just break the awkward thing of meeting someone new this way.
Oh, I love that. I should do that too. You know, or, you know, getting up on stage and being able to play for people, and then I can walk around for the rest of the weekend and people can come up and talk to me.
And do you like that?
I love it.
Really? Okay. Because I think a lot of artists would rather just melt into the, you know, back of the stage and not have to go out in front.
I mean, you know, there's a bit of, like, I like my private time, like, when I need it. Mm-hmm. But, no, I love going out and having a reason for people to come up and talk to me. Especially if they enjoyed it. Actually, sometimes if they haven't.
Do they tell you they don't, though? Like, do you really know how they're feeling at the end of the show?
British people are very honest. German people are very honest. And I've played some shows in England where, like, or people from, like, Norway.
Oh, yeah.
Are, like, very honest. They're like, I saw your set. Didn't particularly enjoy it. I'm like, thank you for your honesty.
That probably feels refreshing, right? Then you know you're having a real moment with someone.
Yeah, yeah. I mean, it's like, you know, we like to blow smoke in America.
Yes.
But sometimes when you go overseas, like, it's just not a part of their culture. They're just like, and I think it's interesting when they feel the need to tell me that I didn't like this verse on this song. I thought that it was a bit trite, a bit shallow. I'm like, I'll work on that for next time. Thanks.
Does it ever inspire you to go back and take a check?
Sometimes, yeah.
Yeah.
I mean, I've got bandmates that, you know, kind of hold my feet to the fire on certain lyrics. They're like, that's a bit of a cheap line. I'm like, God, you're right. And I wish
you
wouldn't have noticed
that. Also, because you've elevated yourself to this place of being above those cheap lines, it's even more pressure.
It is a lot of pressure. And when the bandmates figure that out, and I'm like, I knew it was a cheap line, and I knew I was getting the easy route, and you noticed it.
If you're just tuning in, this is a conversation with a reluctant therapist. I'm Elizabeth Barrett. My guest today is the Sam Chase. Chatting backstage at Live Oak Music Festival after, as I said earlier, you elevated that crowd.
Connection. Yeah.
So when you started writing these songs, the acoustic soft underbelly songs to yourself, was this a way of managing mental health? Were you kind of going through it, or was it just angsty person things?
Well, I would say that probably there, you know, when I started playing guitar, Kurt Cobain was my idol, and he was the king of angst. And so definitely whatever angst I thought I was feeling, I think was probably related to idolizing somebody that had true, honest angst. Mm-hmm, whereas mine was probably a bit more put on. But I had a lot of emotions that I didn't really know how to process in any way. And the best way for me to process it was to sit with those emotions with a guitar and put it to music. And so from like the very start of when I started playing guitar, which was at like 13, 14, somewhere around there, which I think is the perfect age to start writing songs. I wrote some deeply, deeply emotional songs and deeply dark songs that when I showed them to my parents, they were like, Jesus. And, but they...
Let's go back to Angel in Montgomery, right?
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, I mean, maybe...
From Montgomery.
Yeah, maybe that had something to do with it, too.
But what was the first song?
The first song I wrote was called Motel. And it was a song that wasn't about me, but it was about the emotion of feeling alone in a motel. And then my mind, it was like some kind of roadside motel where the walls are paper thin. Mm-hmm. Some people are getting it on in the other room,
Magic
or the TV is too long, and or TV's too loud, and you know, and it's, you get, there's a spider crawling on the wall and you're looking at the spider thinking about what a life that spider has lived compared to my own and how we're not so different. And, you know, and it kind of is this kind of downward spiral of a song about some burnout in a roadside motel.
That's pretty heavy for 14 years old.
And that's why my parents were like, Jesus Christ.
Do we need some help here?
Yeah. Yeah. But I mean, it was a pretty good song. All things considered.
Do you still keep it in your rotation at all?
No way.
Okay.
No way. I mean, it's still very juvenile. Mm-hmm. Like, I don't think it was particularly worthy of going anywhere at that time. But, you know, I jumped in the deep end of writing songs that were, like, deeply personal. And while at the time was not someone that showed my feelings all that much.
Were you not encouraged to?
No, well, I mean, I think like I'm just kind of a man of a certain era and a certain age and a byproduct of it.
Willie Loman or something.
Yeah. Yeah. I'm a little bit younger than him.
Just a couple of years.
But I mean, you know, it's like growing up in the 80s, like there still was a lot of that. And It wasn't until actually I found like grunge music and like Kurt Cobain and like a lot of punk stuff where I was like, oh, men can share their feelings in ways that aren't unhealthy or violent or abusive. They can actually like share their feelings in a true and honest way. And I found that through music. And so for many, many years, people that I knew, once they heard my music, they were actually like, oh, you're a much deeper pond than I thought.
Interesting.
Yeah, because like that was the way that I was sharing my feelings about things.
Did you write about heartache and heartbreak and lost loves, or was it always the existential?
It was more existential stuff. And, you know, a lot of it was kind of the kind of down and out kind of songs. Mm-hmm. And, you know, there's still a lot of that. A lot of it is me like looking at other people's lives too and reflecting on my own based on the stuff that's building around me, the suffering that's happening with other people and how like I'm, you know, my own reflection of it.
Do you feel responsible to be one of the lights of the world?
The third verse is always the one where things come around.
Yeah. You mentioned that before, that the story has to have the surprise for you. So what are you working on these days? What comes up? Were you too busy touring?
We're trying to put down a couple albums right now. We got a full band album, then I'm putting out a trio album, which is just the violin, cello, acoustic guitar. It's the softer songs, more of the underbelly songs, more of the emotional songs, more of the, you know, existential songs. We're trying to put that out this year as well with the full band album. The single that we have coming out on July 2nd is called This Will Be Condos You Can't Afford, which is all about San Francisco and the closing of beloved hallowed halls of rock and roll. These little venues that are, you know, closing left and right in order to build six stories of unattainable condos. Which I think is also pretty universal in most big cities right now.
I wonder what it's like for you, having grown up there, to see it change this Wade.
Well, growing up in San Francisco, I've learned to get used to change. Mm-hmm. I've learned to get used to basically people metaphorically moving into my house and moving all the furniture around. And because San Francisco is a city of people made up of people that aren't from San Francisco, kind of coming in every 10 years, moving all the furniture around and like making it their home. And then like 10 years later, a bunch of newcomers come in and move all the furniture in different ways. And then the people from before go, what are you doing? You ruined it. This is the way it's always been. And it's like, I've seen that like ebb and flow so many times. But, you know, also I don't particularly enjoy change, but I've gotten used to the fact that like every school I've ever gone to has been torn down.
Really?
Yeah. Every, you know, some of my favorite music venues have gone away. And then some of my new favorite music venues have cropped up and, you know, it's almost like I've never had to move to a different city because a new city moves underneath my feet every 10 years, which is kind of cool in many ways.
You know, that was a song lyric you just said.
Was it somebody else's?
No, it's yours. It's excellent.
Okay, I'll put it in there. Yeah. I was like, what was that, train?
No, yeah, I wouldn't do that to you. No, but that was beautiful, Sam. I mean, that was like you spoke that so perfectly that I can visualize what you're explaining.
Well, thank you. Yeah, I mean, you know, everywhere we go, things are cheaper and easier. But I love my city. And I feel like one of the last centuries of my hometown that are there, like gargoyles, just to like watch over the scene to make sure that it stays weird, that it still has culture, music, art, and that people who are there are people that would appreciate it. I have no enforcement capabilities. However, you know, just by being there, I feel like if I could, you know, prop up those music scenes or help or write a song like "This Will Be Condos You Can't Afford," I'm doing my part. And in many ways, the city has been really good to me in that regard.
Where in the city do you play now?
We play.
Since you lost some of your favorite venues, where do you?
Well, I mean, Bottom of the Hill is going away at the end of the year. The Parkside is going away on July 4th. But, you know, there's so many other venues that are, you know, old venues and ones that are cropping up too. Like the Independent is a fantastic venue. The Fillmore is a fantastic venue. You know, but the types of venues that we're losing are the ones that are below that in terms of capacity. Mm-hmm. The mid-sized venues are what we're missing. And the thing that's unfortunate about that is that we're kind of cutting these young bands off at the knee because they don't have anywhere to cut their teeth. Mm-hmm. They're cutting their teeth in like smaller dive bars. And then what? They're going to jump from a dive bar to a 500 cap place. It's not going to work. You know, so they need to go elsewhere in order to like build their bands and their fan base and stuff. And that's what I worry about the most. So for me, yes, it's unfortunate that these venues are going away, but I have hope and I'm trying my best to make sure that people know that it's okay to start a new venue that might be the next Bottom of the Hill or the next Parkside and continue that dream and work towards keeping San Francisco a place where art and culture and music can be celebrated rather than something of a bygone era.
That's your third verse.
Yeah. Yeah. That was a mouthful of a verse.
It was good. Yeah. I liked it. Sam Chase, thank you so much for spending some time with me.
Yeah.
You've been listening to my conversation with Sam Chase.
The band is The Sam Chase and The Untraditional.
Thank you. The Sam Chase and The Untraditional, right here playing at Live Oak Music Festival 2026. I appreciate your time. Thank you for jumping up and being willing to get in my truck with me and go for a journey.
It's a great truck.
Thank you. It's totally comfortable. It's gone places. This has been a conversation with a reluctant therapist. I'm Elizabeth Barrett. You can listen to previous shows at kcbx.org. Find us on Spotify. Find us on NPR Podcasts. And as always, you can send me a message to Elizabeth at thereluctanttherapist.com or find me on Instagram and Facebook. And you can find The Sam Chase probably at
the internet. TheSamChase.com. We're also on all the streaming stuff. Just look up The Sam Chase. You'll find all you need to know.
Fabulous. This is Central Coast Public Radio, KCBX.
Trying to tell you what this song's about. I say what I mean, but nothing comes out. But you can tell from my face what I'm showing is true. But you don't need my words, 'cause you had that face too. There and I, up on that stage. Singing all the songs, oh, the campfire's raging. not behaving in the ways I'd intended. When I woke up this morning, there and I, out with my friend, where I don't know when enough is enough. But the morning still comes, as it always does, where I look into that mirror and I swear all that stops. But there is one thing that I know. Baby, you're there for me.